from the heart of the Forest City, this is a Craig Needles podcast brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It is the Craig Needles podcast, and yes, it is the Friday Roundtable back after a week away, and I am thrilled to be joined here in the studio by our panelists. We have activist Mojde Cox, political insiders Shobhita Sharma and Nathan Smith. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for being here.
Hello.
There's a lot going on this week, and a lot of it winds up being provincial stuff that really has an impact on us here in London, including a conversation that was had at City Hall this week, one of the very first conversations this new council has had, and Mayor Josh Morgan decided to call a special meeting, which I thought was a good idea, to say, hey, look, we've got this situation with the province, the way that they're going to go about changing development fees. I know that the development fee stuff is boring for most people, but the part that kind of sticks out is the multi-million dollar, we're talking like $70-80 million hole in the city's budget that could come because of this. And council, by a 15-0 vote, decided, hey, we're going to say to the province, this is a bad idea. This is done under the guise of housing, but what's your reaction to A, what the premier is pushing here, and B, the London City Council's reaction to it this week?
I can start there, Greg.
Sure.
Craig, if that's okay. I mean, it's just the name of the bill itself is frightening, and the impulsive nature and the way that it has came onto the scene onto our conversations is really troubling. I'm in line with our city councilor's calls to slow the bill down. This is just a really bad idea. Urban planning is not a one-size-fits-all. It is not the responsibility of the province in this way to impede on city planners' ability to do so in a hyper-local context, plan the city out. This is going to be leading into catastrophic rural sprawl, and I am personally going to be impacted by that. I now am right outside the periphery of London, and I can see it happening right before my eyes. Why I think it's a bad idea around rural sprawl, I hope I don't have to name it. We already don't actively participate in our own food security the way we can. Our farmland is deteriorating. Are we even going to be the forest city after this? These are the questions that I think we need to ask on the environmental front, let alone like how this deteriorates democracy, no public input, very little time for even municipalities to respond. It's tyrannical. It is immature, short-sighted, and really typical of the Ford government.
Like, I don't think that anybody's going to argue that housing is a crisis. There's a crisis in housing in Ontario and Canada. But I don't know if this was the right approach to I don't know if there was any consultation with municipalities at any time. I would have liked to see more collaboration and actually the province asking municipalities for their input, asking our local planners, for example, to come to the table with solutions that made sense for each community. And treating those communities as individual communities because their needs are different and there are different issues. I was a little surprised, but actually, should I even be surprised? Like, this is not the first time this government's done this, and this is probably not the last time, so.
Well, I think I'll sort of try to get a bit of optimism. I don't think it's going to be the last time either the government goes back on something where they made what seems to be a pretty clear error in judgment. And I think just based on not only the reaction in London, which was unanimous, but the reaction in almost every other municipality that has spoken about this so far has been equally unanimous, regardless of whether you're right-leaning, left-leaning, centrist, doesn't matter. Everybody is opposed to it. So, like you said, Shobhita, on the front end of it, almost everybody seems to be in agreement that we need to build more houses quicker. Everybody also agrees that this is the wrong way to go about it. So if you kind of start from scratch again and sort of do the consultation, figure out what is the best path forward, I think we'll get there. But it's unfortunate that, again, it sort of emerged in this way. And if we're trying to do this quickly, that we will have wasted some time sort of getting a mechanism that will allow us to do that when it could have been sort of expedited, I think, had they gone a different path off the top.
One of the things that frustrates me, but I was struck by in London, you know, people are going to say, well, you know, you guys are picking on the Conservatives and picking on poor Doug Ford. This was a 15-0 vote at London City Council. And, you know, Paul Van Meerbergen, reputation as a pretty conservative guy. Even he stood up and said, hey, look, I know what the province wants to do here, but this is not the way to do it. And there are going to be some pretty significant unintended consequences. And we hearing numbers about tax hikes. I don't think we heard that in London as far as this is the percent that we're going to have to hike taxes in order to pay for this. But other municipalities, their staff was doing that, saying, hey, if we're going to change the way development fees go, we're going to have to hike property taxes by this percent. And that's just going to be remarkably unpopular. I think people would much rather developers be paying for those fees than the tax base itself. And I know the developers may not love to hear that, but we're just talking about retail politics here. So I think the government will go back on this, much like they went back on the notwithstanding mm-hmm. clause situation, much like they went back on the, hey, we're going to shut down parks for an indefinite amount of time because of COVID situation. Once they sort of get blowback to this stuff, they have shown a propensity to try to reverse it a little bit and back up. I suspect that'll happen here. It's a matter of when and what it looks like when it's done. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And you know what? I want to go back to the topic of the taxes. $97 million of impact over 5 years is no joke. So if any municipality is not speaking about possible tax hikes, it's really unrealistic to proceed thinking that that's going to happen. So speaking of that, like, I personally believe in paying taxes for the greater good and to improve our collective outcomes, but I don't want that to be as a result of the Ford government's impulsive and irresponsible decisions imposed on municipalities where it doesn't actually make any sense. So I that's where my heart's sitting with this. I think that inevitably we're going to be paying for their misguidance and poor decision making.
So I think it comes down to like dollars and cents for the cities, correct? Like for municipalities, whereas I think for the government it's a plan that they're now trickling down to municipalities, but it's the municipalities are having to shoulder what are they going to cut and where are they going to increase taxes, which is ridiculous given the state of our economy right now, where we're going, but also this is not what the municipalities asked for.
Yeah, well, I think another interesting voice that, I mean, Craig highlighted Councillor Van Meerbergen's opposition to it. But I think there was only one delegation, I believe, when council was dealing with it. It was Mike Wallace from LDI.
Yep.
And if anybody, you figure if any sector is going to be in favor of this, it would be that. But he came to council and basically said, look, we'll support whatever you decide to do. Mm-hmm. Difficult decision. We're not pushing you one way or the other. So if you can't get that group and that sector in your favor on a bill like this, I think it's clearly time to go back to the drawing board. And I agree with you, Craig. I think they will. And not just because I believe it's in their hearts to do so, but they've demonstrated it multiple times across their time in government that they'll sort of make a misstep off the top and then they go back and try to fix it. And it's the time that is wasted in doing that that is sacrificed, especially when you're trying to expedite a process. It slows it down.
I agree. It's the opportunity cost of getting something done fast versus having to redo it and then losing all of this time and having people still struggle to find appropriate housing, to find those or to meet those needs of the people here in Ontario. So,
What is housing changes to the way that we do that in the province look like then? What's if this is the wrong way to do it? What's the right way in order to build more houses faster? Because we've seen the projections, and Mike Moffitt's been on this podcast several times saying, hey, we probably need 1.5 million homes in the province of Ontario. I don't know if the province has the projections in order to make that happen. But there's no if about it. We do need more homes to be built faster in the province. How do we make that happen? Because this is clearly not the right way.
It's certainly not developing on farmland $900,000 homes.
No.
How's that for a start? Like, for this to be a housing solution is absurd to me. It's a complete disconnect as to the type of housing crisis we're actually talking about. We need affordable housing. We need mixed income. We have expert advice already out there. We don't need to rhyme it off. Craig, we've heard it over and over again from folks that you've even had at your roundtable. The guidance that we need is already out there. We just have to listen to the folks that are in that space and are dealing with the implications of our housing crisis on a daily basis.
And I think, we've talked about this previously as well, but we need our provincial partners at the table. But I think that the input from municipalities is so crucial, and it cannot happen in silos anyway. So I think there's more collaboration needed to be able to get to that target, Craig.
Yeah, I agree. And I just don't know. I don't know if we've got the right people in place to make that collaboration happen, because Mojda, as you pointed out, developing the green belt is not a housing solution. Housing solutions are, you know, more infill. And yeah, are there spaces to build more, you know, single family homes? Yes, those spaces exist. But when we're talking about housing solutions, we're talking about, we're going to build stuff that's tall in the city's downtown cores, or we're going to build, look at the London psychiatric hospital lands right now, and we're going to be building housing there. It's not going to be a bunch of single family homes, but it's going to be a place for a lot of people to live, which is good. So I think it's stuff like that, which I understand there's red tape and the things that go along that line with it, but what we're doing right now, which is, oh yeah, we're just gonna, you know, build a few homes that go for nearly $1 million a pop, an hour drive out of Toronto. I'm sorry, that doesn't solve any of this problem. We've got to find better ways to do it than that. And here in London, I think we've got to find better ways to do it than that. And there are some good projects that are on the way, I think. And I think that does need to be highlighted. What else can be added to the housing conversation that perhaps needs to be, that maybe the provincial government's missing, in any of your opinions?
Well, I mean, part of it, and it's not even necessarily a provincial government solution, but part of it is there's a lack of planning staff that can keep up with mm-hmm. the applications, not just here, but in a lot of centers. And there's just, that's a systemic issue that you just can't sort of fix with legislation, but you could have the greatest plan. If you don't have enough bodies to actually go through the plans and process them in a timely manner, you're going to get backlogs, and you're going to have, you see how the economy changes from month to month. Like, things that looked good sort of 6 months ago when they get to be approved are not looking so good. And so you're spinning. So that's a big part of it. And I don't know personally how you address that, but it's something that needs to be considered as part of the overall picture.
Yeah.
I mean, a hit to a budget like that also means no chance of really scaling up social housing. What is our immediate issue? We are talking about a really layered and complex issue, this housing crisis. It's directly linked to the affordability crisis. What we call affordable, is it in line with those who are living in deep abject poverty and chronic homelessness and being chronically underhoused? This is a human problem we created that we can actually solve, and now we're dancing around it over this really impulsive decision that lacks transparency. Going back to the Greenbelt, I just want to mention, it's swapping land with an IOU with lack of transparency and whether we would actually get equal amount of conservation land back. So none of this is built on trust. How is this a solution for affordable housing when experts are saying, those on the ground are saying, this is precisely what we need? We're undermining all of that, and we're actually scrapping any chance of social housing scaling up in this area, which is desperately needed. Subsidized social housing is desperately needed that is adequate and up to code. People can live in safety and dignity.
It's got to happen, and I just... I get frustrated by some of the resistance of some of these projects that are, you know, within cities, that are, you know, close to the downtown core, within the downtown core. Like, this stuff has to happen. This stuff has to get built. And I think that the sooner we all realize that, the better off we're going to be. A few of the topics I want to talk about on this edition of the podcast. But first, I do want to remind you that the Craig Needles podcast is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London. Luxury redefined. You can find them at 1065 Warncliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. Another provincial issue that impacts us here. This week, London Health Science Centre came out and said, we are going to have to postpone or change around the dates for some surgeries at Children's Hospital because staff at the Kids ER are so overwhelmed by the number of kids that are coming in there. Obviously a significant problem. The government has said that, hey, you know, we're doing what we can about this. I saw Sylvia Jones tweeting about that today, her kind of taking a little tour through a hospital somewhere in the province, not sure where. Of course, advocates would say, no, they are not doing anything about that. What's the problem with our healthcare system right now? Is it just, you know, a seasonal thing that we're just going to have to deal with this every year? Or are there other obviously underlying issues here that need to be dealt with if we're going to not have to postpone surgeries at children's hospitals?
Well, it would have been nice. We had a provincial election where people were talking about healthcare. Like, yeah, it was a good time to do that. And again, we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating that none of the three major parties really did, which was shocking given, you know, what we were in the midst of, that healthcare was not a real issue. And not just, you know, public health measures and funding. We need both of those. We need more funding. But we also need to look at how we do healthcare, period. Like, it's time for Canada to sort of get off its high horse in general, admit that you don't need to abandon entirely what we're doing, but there are a multitude of other ways to deliver healthcare. And I'm talking about the boogeyman, we'll do it the way the United States does. Don't do that. That's the polar opposite, which is horrific. But there's all kinds of European countries that do it in different ways, taking bits and pieces of different systems. And you're not seeing this issue to this degree in other sort of developed countries the way we are here. So I hope that at some point, whether it's this catastrophe or the next one or the one after that, that we start to have at least a conversation, which up until recently had been completely taboo. As soon as you talk about, is there different ways that we could deliver healthcare?
And are just, you saying privatization?
No, that's not what I'm saying. And that has been the conversation for so long that, well, if you're talking about this, it must be the... No, I'm not talking about that. But there's other... I mean, I don't think that... You know, the way they do it in Sweden or a lot of Nordic countries or even in England, that these are like hardcore capitalists where are good systems.
Maybe if we start treating our healthcare workers a little bit better,
yes,
start paying them a little bit better than what they have already.
They're
fatigued. They're underpaid. Mm. Our hospitals are understaffed. And now children's hospitals are canceling surgeries. And these surgeries are not elective mostly. Yeah. Like, children don't get elective surgeries from what I understand. So now we're stopping... But now we're stopping people from getting surgeries that could possibly save their lives, and that's just heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And I hate it when we're talking about, this goes on in every election cycle, right? Like, this is the system that got handed down to us, all of that jazz. No, fix it. Yeah. Someone needs to step up to the plate and fix it. Let's not wait for another election cycle to fix this thing. We need a solution now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, two things stand out in my mind. Sorry, Craig, for interrupting.
Go ahead.
Two things. One is, on the worker front, this is a direct result of not recognizing, quote unquote, what the federal government calls foreign, certified and accredited individuals. So, you know, I have a personal story with this. I've lived in this country for almost 34 years now. And, you know, my personal family story is that, you know, you come with a master's degree and 25 years of experience in your field, and somehow none of that matters once you cross the border. And I wish that they would have told us that upon applying for landed status. Now, you know, my family was in a bit of a dire situation. We were coming from refugee status to landed status, which makes a bit of a difference. So here's the problem. We have a shortage of professionals, yet we have an abundance of healthcare professionals in retail, driving taxis, doing work that, in fact, within the healthcare system that could help support and bolster some of the areas around nursing and surgical needs, in fact, doing work that is not the caliber of their training and accreditation. We are dealing with the potential mass brain drain in Canada if we don't address this issue. So if we think healthcare crisis is where we're going to start with all of this, no thanks. It's actually going to span out into different areas of work as well. We need to recognize foreign accreditation, and this problem will be solved.
Yeah, and that's another thing. That it seems like most elections it's talked about.
Yes.
We're going to fix it, and then they don't fix it. It never gets addressed, and you're into the next election, and it's the same promises. So I just think, everybody is right. There's all sorts of things we need to do. I just think part of it needs to be, and I think the issue in Canada is that we're so, and in a lot of reasons, justifiably so, proud of our healthcare system that it's part of the national identity in the same way that hockey is. And if you suggest that Canada is not the best at hockey, it's like, of course we are. It's like, we could still be really good, but there might be people that are better. And there might be ways to improve our game. There might be ways to improve the healthcare system. If you just sort of have the, you know, self-awareness to admit that possibly some other countries might have some ideas on things that could improve how we deliver this, so you don't have these situations that are embarrassing, and they're sad when, especially when it gets to the level of the most vulnerable or the elderly or children who can't get basic treatment. Mm-hmm. There are ready-made solutions like you identified, Mojde, and as you identified, Shobita, and there's others that take more time. But there's things you can do quickly, and there's things you can do sort of more long-term. We should be doing all of them.
Well, and so that this problem not, I don't know if this is going to resolve like tomorrow, but I think if we start tomorrow, maybe in the next 4 years, it's going to start getting a little bit better. because we can't continue this way. Like,
this isn't going away. This is scary. This isn't like, well, this is a bad year for whatever it is we're dealing with, and then we'll see it again. Like, yeah. And it was the same thing during COVID that, yeah. you know, certainly there were deaths and illnesses that were occurring, but in terms of the impact on the overall society, it impacted us to greater degrees in other sort of developed countries because we just don't have the capacity to deal with a slight increase in illness. So it needs to be addressed, and we're being reminded on a regular basis now with increasing frequency that it needs to be addressed. So I hope at some point the dam breaks and we just start doing some things.
And I was just going to say, I think today the province said that, or the province is asking family doctors to extend their hours so that they can cope with some of the patients. But I'm like, I think they're already overworked too. Like, try getting a doctor's appointment. Try going to a walk-in clinic and finding one that's still taking patients after like 12 o'clock in the afternoon, because everyone's always booked. It's all done. Mm-hmm. And so it's the crisis is very real. The crisis is in front of us right now.
Yeah.
What I fear the most is that it really is that, to Nathan's point, the this or that conversation.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be public versus private. And in fact, what this crisis is doing is normalizing the conversation around privatization of our healthcare, which is frightening. It actually will deplete Canada's value proposition for any border, movement. Folks are going to leave. If every aspect of what draws people to Canada is now deteriorating under poor leadership, what's our value proposition? We actually don't have national healthcare anymore. We actually don't we don't actually have a democratic system that's intact. Like, this is tied to a far bigger issue, and a conversation of privatization is being normalized right before our eyes, and people are going to go to a private system and go across the border, access services, and that is going to be our demise. Unfortunately, don't come to me for inspiration, I guess, but that's what I see happening.
It's got to get, there's so much that has to get worked on, has to get handled. I will say to Monty McNaughton's credit, and he was tweeting about this week, and I'm trying to get him on the podcast for next week. He was saying that they've got an agreement, the Ontario and the federal government have an agreement that is going to recognize more foreign credentials in immigration for professionals, and I would assume that includes medical professionals, but I want to ask him. So that's good. I have no idea what the details are, but at least this is something that they're trying to actually accomplish as opposed to just talking about, which is good. But it just we're in a bad way here, and it's a very negative situation. And I think that the pandemic kind of underlined problems that we were already having, and is now sort of shoved those problems more into the spotlight. Whereas, like, let's be honest here, when we're talking about what's going on with children's hospitals and surgeries and whatnot there, that's not COVID-19 that's doing that.
No,
that's other illnesses that are moving around the community that are doing that. Kids, for the most part, I'm not saying every single kid, but for the most part, kids are not showing up at hospitals with COVID-19. It's other stuff. So there's that element of it as well. Want to talk about, before we go, Justin Trudeau is in Ottawa today, and he is talking about what went on with the Emergencies Act. He's at that inquiry. Chrystia Freeland was there yesterday. We were talking about this kind of towards the end of Trudeau's time at the inquiry, but he's essentially saying, I stand by that decision. I talked to my cabinet about it. They seem to think it was the right decision. I talked to premiers about it. They seem to think it was the right decision. I think there are some legitimate criticisms of the government here as far as the fact that the Emergencies Act was used. I'm wondering if you think the Canadians care, or do you think this is a situation where Canadians are just, for the most part, not everybody, saying, I don't really like the convoy, so I'm just glad they did whatever it is they needed to do to get those people out of there. Where do you think people mostly stand on this? Is it really a needle mover either way for you?
I think where we should stand is the fact that there were arms at one of our border crossings. Mm-hmm. That was a scary situation. There were people flying Nazi flags in Ottawa, right around our parliament. That was a scary and a very dangerous situation. And it needed to be resolved. And I think that's what we need to remember.
Yeah. It needed to be resolved. I think that there are some worthy criticisms of, hey, did you have to use these particular tools? I just don't know how many Canadians are actually going to care about getting into the nitty-gritty of that. I think most people are going to say, oh, yeah, no, we had to get those people out of there.
Well, that's the thing. I think you, Craig, because I've seen your tweets and a few others, are among the select few who actually parse it and say, okay, I wasn't in favor of the convoy, but I do have questions about the Emergencies Act. I think the vast majority of people have already made up their mind one way or the other. Mm-hmm. If they support the convoy, they hate the Emergencies Act. If they weren't in favor of the convoy, they love the idea. There are very few people that are kind of trying to find a middle lane there. And so I think most people have already made up their minds on this. It can be interesting political theater for some, but I think the vast majority have already figured out which way they fall on the issue. And it's just sort of almost another committee hearing, even though it's historic by nature. Mm-hmm. But I think to the average person, is another committee hearing in Ottawa that's ongoing.
I wonder if Canadians will care if they did the addition of what all of this has cost us. So forget about the topic of the inquest, okay? Because I didn't dare look that number up because I didn't want to know, frankly. Because what I found out was enough for me to say, like, I think the numbers tell a really interesting story. $7 million in overall costs over the 3 week for the protests of 17 different Ottawa services. $55 million. We're talking millions, okay? Just imagine what we can do with $55 million right now for people who are the most vulnerable. That's what the city says it took for the Ottawa Police Services to address the demonstration, $55 million. $4.4 million in additional Ottawa Police Service costs to manage the Rolling Thunder protest that descended on the city's downtown. I mean, the amount of money, and frankly, if we want to then have the conversation about why we should be reallocating costs and funding from provincial police and municipal police, is that, like, if in 3 weeks you can't shut down a protest, last time I heard, a few protests on Parliament Hill took about 3 hours to shut down. So I don't understand the disparity between, you know, folks fighting for Indigenous rights and justice on Parliament Hill, who were shut down and escorted with arms police, making sure they never return, to 3 weeks of absolute hate and violence being spewed. Forget about the type of absolute disruption that residents in that area experienced.
Yeah, to me, and it's appalling. I can be naive about, you know, my liberties or what have you, but I'm less interested in whether the Emergencies Act was justified or not versus how was it allowed to become as big as it did? How were they able to become as entrenched as they were, given, as you laid out, all the other protests or demonstrations that are usually quickly dispersed, sometimes with, you know, violence or heavy-handedness? And this was, we've seen bits of testimony as well where there were police officers there who were giving them information, and that sort of was.
It was also the opposition members,
like that, and that happens in the U.S. as well. And so that, mm-hmm. to me, is a far more concerning and even a more interesting topic than whether they were justified in issuing the.
I would agree with that, because I think the biggest story here is the incompetence of Ottawa Police and the OPP and coordination in general,
because there's a lot of different agencies, like you said, that are involved. But yeah, how this was able to get as big and as entrenched as it did.
Yeah.
There was support, but there was also, like, moral support from our opposition leaders and our people from the conservatives who went and shook hands. They went to these, I don't want to call them protesters because that's not the convoy members or whatever, but they were there. And so that's how it got that entrenched. Like, that's why they were like, no, we're going to stay here because we have support.
Yeah. Blow up hot tubs.
And I know.
Like blow up hot tubs. Can we go down memory lane for a moment, Shobita? Yeah. Do you remember in 2015, 2016, Black Lives Matter shut down the Allen Expressway for like 5 minutes and the province lost their minds? And we shut those. There was such deep criticism for maybe two dozen immediate Black Lives Matter organizers saying, stop killing us. And that was enough to an uproar for a momentarily blockade of the highway. 3 weeks. This is absolute. This is injustice in this country. This is a lack of democracy. This is a lack of. It is an awful place to be. And I think after the convoy, certain things come to mind for me as a person living in this city. Is that Canadian flag a patriotic one, or is that one representative of something that's going to harm me and others that look like me? So it's unfortunate that not enough people care, but let's see if the numbers add up and if we take people down memory lane and see what the direct response has been. between the type of civil disobedience we've seen in this province, how the reactions differ, is really startling.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say. And we'll leave it there just because I know that folks got places to be and I've got a studio to vacate and all that lovely stuff. But thank you very much to Nathan and Shobita and Mojde for coming in and talking about the issues of the week with us this week. Of course, more of the Craig Needles podcast can be found at classicrock981.com and londonnewstoday.ca. You can also, of course, know that the Craig Needles podcast is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with the drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London. Luxury defined. You can find them at 1065 Warncliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.